You are now listening to CJSS 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, consider all the injustice, death and destruction gone down in Palestine over the past 50, 75, 100 years. No one is more responsible for the Palestinian people's misery than the British.
The Brits, you know, they're the authors of what happened. There's no attempt to issue an apology. There's no real apology that they've issued for the Palestinians. The displacement, the compensation of people losing not just lives and loved ones, but properties as well that were confiscated.
Then, a looming famine and genocide in Gaza. Will the UK, US, Canada, and other Western powers act? Or will they render Israel aid and support?
Does Andrew Mitchell, the UK Development Minister, does David Cameron, the UK Foreign Secretary, does Antony Blinken, do the Trudeau administration, do they really want to find themselves being judged by history to have been complicit in genocide and starvation? Because to be clear, it isn't imminent. It is going on right now.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Sometime in the next 6 months, the International Court of Justice in The Hague will issue an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's 57-year occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. The UN top court will be responding to a request from the UN General Assembly, asking it to determine whether Israel's occupation is actually legal, and if not, what Israel's obligations are under international law and what the obligations of third states are to set things right. If Israel's occupation is deemed unlawful, its settlement enterprise certainly is, all UN member states would be obliged not to acknowledge the legal validity of Israel's prolonged occupation nor render it aid and assistance. Arguably, no country bears greater responsibility for all this mess than Britain, which asked the ICJ not to render an advisory opinion, or if it did, not to go into all the history. A rich request. As mandatory power in Palestine under the League of Nations Covenant and Mandate System following World War I, Britain was obliged to prepare Palestine's people for independence. In a census carried out at the start of the mandate, Britain determined that 78% of Palestine's people were Arab Muslims, 10% were Christian, 11% were Jewish. Having carried out its census, rather than building independence for the majority of Palestine's people, Britain turned around and handed Palestine over to European colonists of Jewish persuasion. The rest is history. I spoke about all this and the ICJ advisory opinion hearings with Victor Catton. Catton is assistant professor in public international law at the University of Nottingham School of Law and the author of the 2009 work From Coexistence to Conquest, International Law and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, 1891 to 1949. I reached Victor Catton in Nottingham just before ICJ hearings wrapped up. It's interesting that in the course of the advisory opinion hearings that are going to conclude in about an hour, most countries are telling the International Court of Justice to render a solid advisory opinion with a broad context, broadly framed, going back to the Balfour Declaration in its analysis. But there's about, a certain number of countries that are saying that the ICJ should not render an advisory opinion at all. It should use its discretion not to render an advisory opinion, and that because it would only complicate matters, right? It would only complicate the peace process. And if it did, it should really issue a narrow, narrowly framed opinion focusing on helping the Security Council to reach a peace agreement, but not within the wider historical frame, going back to, many people in the course of the hearings have gone back to Balfour, the 1920 to start of the mandate, Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. They're saying, don't consider that. It's just too complicated. So in the context of international law and the origins of the Arab-Israeli conflict, to what degree would you say all this history plays a role in the current conflict?
Well, I think it's pivotal to understanding how the conflict began. It didn't begin on the 7th of October or 20 or 30 years ago. It goes back to decisions that were made during the colonial period in European capitals, anti-Semitism, migration, huge migration of people from fleeing persecution, rise of nationalism in the Arab world, the end of the caliphate, and also decisions that were made by British colonial officials, made in the heat of the moment, perhaps not so thinking of the longer term consequences, then regretting these decisions, but not being in a position to, not being honest enough to say that that they should change or reverse course. So, you know, you got the Balfour policy, you had the Aliens Act prior to that, you had different plans. You had an uprising from the Palestinians opposing British policy to support the establishment of a Jewish national home almost immediately following the declaration in 1917, and these reports were suppressed. But nonetheless, there were concerns raised in the House of Lords, House of Commons, League of Nations in the 1920s. There were safeguard clauses, as you know, protecting the rights of Jews in other countries, protecting the rights of non-Jews in Palestine. There was a right of self-government enshrined in the Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations. How do you reconcile that? Promising the Jewish people a national home, but then also recognizing that the indigenous population also had a right of self-government.
Do you think, Victor Catton, do you think that Britain violated its fiduciary duty to the Palestinian people under the mandate?
Yes, I do. And I think that the way they administered the mandate and the way they left, which I don't cover sufficiently in sufficient detail in my book, by the way, but which I've subsequently done a lot of unpublished work and advisory work, the way in which the Brits left the mandate in a state of chaos and violence after causing the mess, thwarting the United Nations plan to establish two states in a kind of confederal structure with an economic union. I think a lot of people forget that the 1947 partition plan was a plan of open borders. It wasn't, did not envisage barbed wire and walls and military fortifications. So I think the way that they administered it was wrong, unlawful, and I argued that in the book. But also the way they left the mandate with no proper plan for what would happen after they left.
I mean, I was thinking about this, how to describe Britain's role in the current situation today, like, you know, 100 years later, 80 years later. And I was kind of thinking of describing Britain as the principal intellectual author of the Palestinian people's dispossession.
No, absolutely. I mean, you can see it from even prior to the Balfour policy, but you can see that decisions they made up to 1939 and also subsequently. So in 1939, they abandoned the policy ostensibly, but they still didn't support or didn't take enough steps to assist the Palestinians with creating a state. And since then, and especially in the last, I would say, 10, 15 years, consecutive governments have done very little to assist the Palestinians. They've not taken a hostile position, opposing their attempts to join the International Criminal Court, when I was a legal advisor at the time, which I recall clearly, opposing the current reference to the International Court of Justice for what is essentially a non-binding advisory opinion, although it has important legal consequences. And also they haven't, you know, not really reconciling or not really understanding their role. You know, there's no attempt to issue an apology. No, there's no real apology that they've issued for the Palestinians. The displacement, the compensation of people losing not just lives and loved ones, but properties as well that were either confiscated. But the Brits, you know, they're the authors of what happened.
The British at ICJ hearings last week were amongst those who argued alongside the United States, although I would say even their argument was more fully throated than the United States' argument even. Britain argued that the ICJ should not render an advisory opinion, and if it does, it should render the most narrowly framed opinion as possible and not go back into all this history, which seems to me to be incredibly disingenuous.
Well, the Brits no longer have a judge at the ICJ, so I'm not sure that their views will carry as much weight as they once did. They don't have anyone in the court anymore.
But the judges are supposed to be independent. I mean, the Americans have judges, all the P5, the five permanent powers of the Security Council, they all have their judges who operate independently, so it's not at all clear that a British judge would rule along the lines of British foreign policy.
Well, yeah, but I think when it comes to essential matters, they tend to, and they tend to also articulate their views. I mean, don't forget, these judges are nominated by their governments, and then they are elected by governments. Of course, they sit in an independent capacity. But despite that, judges are sensitive individuals. They grow up in a culture, they grow up in their country, they grow up in a system that they're familiar with. The fact that there isn't a British judge there, I think, does matter, because they can't really articulate. And there's no judge ad hoc, right? The fact that we have judge ad hocs also shows that it's a bit ridiculous, because you're saying that, you know, if you have a dispute between two states and there isn't the nationality of the judge of one of the states that's appearing before the court, they can appoint a judge. And they normally appoint judges of their, not always, but they normally appoint judges from their own countries, which kind of shows you the logic is that, yeah, they sit independently, but at the same time, they recognize that they're more familiar with their own interests. And this is a diplomatic political structure at the end of the day. We can't rule out, you know, the role of power and politics and personalities. And the UK is not what it was once. The UK is not a great power, despite being on the Security Council, that it was 100 years ago. Yeah, Brexit has weakened it, and the fact that they don't have a judge on this very important body, it's not good for them.
So if you were arguing before the International Court of Justice, if you had the chance to get up to the little podium this past week or today to talk to the ICJ, what role would you tell them 100 years of history plays in the creation of the situation today, and the importance of analyzing the situation legally, strictly from a legal perspective, in the context of 100 years of history, not just in the context of post-1967?
Yeah, I mean, if I was asked to appear before the ICJ, I'm not sure I would go back 100 years, because the question was specifically framed in light of the occupation that began in 1967. So, I mean, personally, my personal interest at the moment, the book project I'm working on at the moment, is on the apartheid as a crime against humanity. So I was very pleased to see, I think there were over 22 states that made submissions in some depth describing Israel's policies and practices in the occupied territory, and even in some cases in Israel itself, as breaching the prohibition of apartheid in international law. And we should remember that apartheid is also defined as a crime against humanity. And it was interesting to see also this coming through in the written statements and also in the written comments, and to see some very distinguished lawyers, such as Philippa Webb and Michael Wood, make this argument was quite intriguing. It's becoming more mainstream, I guess is what I'm saying. The apartheid argument, if it began on the fringes of the left, you know, in the 60s and 70s. It was made by human rights. Well, it was then raised in some reports about 15 years ago. Then human rights groups raised it, but in their reports, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, about 2-3 years ago. And now to see the claim being made before the principal judicial organ of the United Nations is quite something, quite a feat, I would say, for the Palestinians.
But in the context of international law, like, what should the ICJ consider and not consider in the context of the relevant legal framework? Fiji, which seems to be a staunch ally of Israel, the representative almost sounded like he was an Israeli, arguing that the Balfour Declaration was and still is legally binding. The 1922 mandate, with Balfour incorporated into it, was an internationally legally binding instrument at the time, and it still is.
Well, it's very intriguing if they make that claim that the mandate's still in force, and that's not good news for the UK, because it could mean any state that was a signatory to the Covenant and the League of Nations could sue the UK.
Well, I think the argument is that Balfour incorporated into the mandate established this idea that Palestine, historic Palestine, would be closely settled by the Jewish people. And it's been argued, were they or were they not thinking of a state? And this has been discussed, I think you did in your book. But clearly, as it moved forward, the idea was clear that what they were moving towards was a Jewish state within historic Palestine, where, you know, 90% of the population was non-Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, but we already have a state of Israel. We don't have a state of Palestine. And so I think that's one of the issues that's subliminally before the ICJ. I mean, but I think it's a bit disingenuous to rely on a colonial document from 1917 to claim it has legal validity today in a world that's outlawed colonialism. International law doesn't support that kind of policy anymore. So you couldn't cite the Balfour Declaration to support Jewish establishment of Jewish settlements in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip if they were to reestablish them there. So I'm not sure how far that argument takes you, plus takes Fiji. Plus, of course, the Balfour Declaration itself has these clauses safeguarding the rights of the indigenous population, and it was subject to the overriding principle in Article 22 of the Covenant, the so-called sacred trust of civilization. So I'm not sure it helps. And in any event, the way in which the Brits and the UN attempted to resolve that dispute was by establishing two states. The State of Israel was established in 1948. The State of Palestine as an independent political entity does not yet exist. And I think that's the issue that people are finally addressing again as I speak.
What do you see the significance of these advisory opinion hearings lying? What's their significance? And what do you see as the greatest impact of an advisory opinion, broadly worded, decisive, incisive advisory opinion?
Well, if it is, like you said, broad and decisive and has a large majority, and if they were to accept some of the arguments that have been made. I mean, one is the occupation, but for me, that's a bit of a fig leaf because I never fought the occupation. I mean, the UN General Assembly request itself defines the occupation as unlawful, so I'm not sure what more the ICJ can add by saying the same thing. But for me, the new novel argument that they've made, as I already mentioned, is this focus on apartheid, because the claim has not been made before the ICJ since the dispute over apartheid in southern Africa, in principally in what is now called Namibia. And there are consequences. There are two consequences. One is, I think I counted this morning so far 16 states that are parties to the 1973 International Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of the Crime of Apartheid made claims that Israel's practicing apartheid. That means that they have taken the view that apartheid applies beyond southern Africa.
They claimed this during the ICJ hearings.
Yes, yeah. Because they are parties to this treaty, they are now, if they want to, they could reestablish the Group of Three. This was this anti-apartheid committee that was suspended in 1995, not abolished, suspended, because in 1995, as you know, there were democratic elections in South Africa. But that could be reconstituted, and the purpose of that committee, the role of that committee, was coordinating actions, divestment, sanctions, trade embargoes, at that time against South Africa. But there's no reason why it could not apply if there's a political will for it to apply to Israel. 109 states are parties to this treaty. It's never been denounced. The machinery is there. So they could do that even before the advisory opinion is issued, because they've already come out and said it. The significance of an advisory opinion, an authoritative advisory opinion by the principal judicial organ of the United Nations, if they were to accept the argument and to take the view that Israel's policies and practices are discriminatory and therefore breach the prohibition on apartheid, that could trigger obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty, which prohibits states' parties from transferring certain types of weapons to states where genocide, crimes against humanity, and grave breaches of international humanitarian law are taking place. This is because apartheid is defined in international law as a crime against humanity. Some activists have tried to do is they've brought judicial review proceedings in third courts. I think there was a successful challenge in the Netherlands with regard to the sale of F-35 spare parts. There was a similar case brought in the UK courts that failed, but the claim in the UK courts was based on the Genocide Convention, the case that South Africa brought against Israel. Now, genocide is very hard to prove. You've got to prove specific intent to destroy a group. in whole or in part. Apartheid is a much easier crime to prove in the sense that it's obvious. You look at a state's constitution, Israel, we have the nation state law. You look at their administrative laws, they look at their practices. And if you can show, as many of these NGOs have done, that apartheid is being breached, and if you have an authoritative statement in the form of an advisory opinion, that could then be brought before domestic courts, even though it's not binding. Well, even the case is not binding. It's only binding between Israel and South Africa. But holding that view, it could provide an avenue for activists or affected individuals, individuals directly affected by the violence, to bring judicial review proceedings in UK courts or in other states such as Germany, which is also a signatory to the arms trade treaty. So it could have consequences in that regard. In the short term, I suspect what will happen, depending on what the court says, that the opinion will be rendered to the body that requested it, which is the United Nations General Assembly. It will take note of the opinion, and then it's really up to Palestinians to draft, you know, language with a view to trying to enforce third states' obligations, to enforce international law. But at the end of the day, the General Assembly can only issue recommendations. So it's really, again, it's a question of political will. The Security Council, as you know, will not enforce it, even if it's referred to it due to the US veto, possibly even the UK would veto a resolution on enforcing international law. So that's kind of where we are at that level. But, I mean, who knows? The Brits have already said if Israel, the British Foreign Office, I believe, has said that if Israel does launch an attack on Rafah, they may, regardless of what the ICJ says, they may restrict the export of weapons to Israel. So that was already being discussed at the moment.
The US, the UK, Canada, and a bunch of EU countries like Germany, they really don't want international law to be applied to the current conflict.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, is that a question or a statement?
No, it's a statement. I mean, they talk about, Israel must abide by, we support Israel's right to defend itself in Gaza, with a caveat that it must abide by the norms of international law. But they just give lip service to the norms of international law. They don't enforce the law. And they were really, really moved heaven and earth to stop the General Assembly from asking the ICJ to render an advisory opinion. They don't want the law to get in the way of Israel's right to do as it pleases.
Yeah, I agree with your assessment.
Thank you so much, Victor.
Thank you. Thanks, David. It's a pleasure.
Victor Catton is Assistant Professor in Public International Law at the University of Nottingham School of Law in the UK and author of the 2009 work From Coexistence to Conquest, International Law and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. I'll link to Victor's other writings at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, please subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about Earth systems, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. Assault on Gaza is now into day 156, ostensibly aimed at wiping out Hamas. Israeli leaders openly admit they aim to wipe out Gaza, slim its population down by 90% or so, driving Gazans into Egypt or wherever, the sea if need be. 5.5 months in, Gazans are starving and sick, all according to plan. Israeli War Minister Yoav Gallant announced at the get-go that all food, water, electricity, and medicine would be cut off from the sliver of a ghetto already under comprehensive siege since 2007. As Israel turns the screws on Gaza, its leaders take aim at an old enemy, the single most important organization on the ground in Gaza, providing Gazans with food, schooling, and other social supports, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. At the end of January, Israel alleged that 12 out of UNRWA's 13,000 staff members in Gaza had joined in with Hamas in its October 7th assault, a hoary Israeli tactic that invariably works for a while. Western powers quickly suspended aid to UNRWA. As it turns out, various media outlets and governments have concluded that Israel's accusations against UNRWA are thin gruel, essentially baseless. Sweden and Canada have renewed funding. Now, as it happens, Israel's hate-on for UNRWA goes back decades, indeed, 4 decades before Hamas came to be, back to UNRWA's founding in 1949, brainchild of Swedish diplomat Count Folke Bernadotte. Bernadotte was the UN's first mediator in Palestine, appointed to the role days after Israel's founding on May 20, 1948. On September 16, 1948, Bernadotte submitted his first plan. Central to the Swedish diplomat's vision, providing for the Palestinian people's right of return to lands they'd been expelled from inside Israel, and, in the interim, creating an agency to help refugees out, that organization would emerge as UNRWA. Bernadotte did not live to see it. One day after submitting his plan, on September 17, 1948, Count Folke Bernadotte was assassinated by Zionist militias led by future Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. I spoke about Count Folke Bernadotte and UNRWA with former UNRWA spokesperson Chris Gunness. I reached Chris Gunness in London. Chris, I'd like to talk about the current situation that UNRWA is facing in Gaza and elsewhere, in the other places where it operates, and of course the current humanitarian situation in Gaza, and the looming famine, accentuated, exacerbated by the difficulties that UNRWA is facing. But I'd like to go back to 1949, when UNRWA was formed. If you could tell me how it was that UNRWA came about. It was officially formed on December 8th, 1949. How did that come about, and what was the role of this Swedish diplomat, Count Folke Bernadotte, who died before UNRWA was formed? But tell me about all that. Tell me about UNRWA's founding and Bernadotte's role in it.
UNRWA was voted into existence by the General Assembly in 1949 and became operational on the ground in May 1950. And this was a response to the 1948 war, which saw 750,000 refugees either forced from their homes or who fled their homes. Those in the north went into Lebanon, those into the northeast went into Syria, some went into Gaza, some went into Jordan, some went to the West Bank. And as UNRWA's name, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, suggests, there was relief, so immediate humanitarian relief for the refugees, which involved obviously medical aid, food aid, shelter, the things that refugees need immediately they flee. But there was also a plan for what they call durable solutions, which was to provide them with works, with employment in the areas where they fled. Now, it soon became apparent that the fledgling state of Israel, contrary to Resolution 194, which embodies the right of return, Israel made it clear that it would not respect that resolution and allow the refugees back to their homes. So in a matter of years, UNRWA began to morph from being a relief organization into a development organization, because the refugees' children needed an education where they were, so UNRWA had to establish schools. There was a need for health, so UNRWA began today is about 150 primary health clinics, and also relief and works. So the refugees needed social support. They needed their social networks. And those three areas, education, health, and relief and social services, today are the main departments in UNRWA's core functions. But of course, because the Middle East is so unstable, UNRWA is constantly having to provide relief and emergency services while continuing to maintain these core services, which are part of its long-term human development strategy. So Gaza today is a very good example. Although UNRWA is running over 700 schools for over 550,000 children across the Middle East in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank and Gaza, although UNRWA is running primary health clinics across the Middle East.